Welcome to The Drummer's Pathway, the podcast about music, life, and the creative process. I'm Michael Scott, and welcome to The Drummer's Pathway podcast. This episode features my conversation with renowned Canadian drummer, Ted Warren. Born and raised in Saskatchewan and now currently residing in southern Ontario, Ted discovered his passion for music at a young age. In addition to becoming inspired by the music of his generation, he also discovered an interest in jazz. Ted went on to study music at Montreal's McGill University and received a certificate in jazz studies from St. Francis Xavier University in Antigonish, Nova Scotia. As an active member of Canada's jazz scene and the recipient of the Jazz Report's Drummer of the Year Award in 1996, Ted has built a solid reputation as a versatile drummer performing and recording with the who's who of the Canadian jazz scene, including the legendary Rob McConnell and the Boss Brass Big Band. He is also a composer and fronts his own quartet, Ted's Warren Commission, which released their debut CD, First Time Caller, to critical acclaim in 2004, and followed that up with the albums Songs for Doug and 2016's The Great Regina Pizza Debate. Ted is a highly regarded teacher, clinician, and adjudicator, and has taught in the jazz studies programs at both Humber College in Toronto and Mohawk College in Hamilton, Ontario. In our conversation, we talk about the importance of embracing your musical ideas and not allowing your own self-doubt to get in your way. We also discuss his approaches to teaching and why the pursuit of learning and exploring new concepts is essential in order to find joy in your own creative endeavors. And now, my conversation with Ted Warren. You have established a reputation as not only being one of Canada's premier jazz musicians, but also a highly respected and regarded educator. So looking back, what was the inspiration for you to pursue music, and in particular, the drum set?
Yeah, that's sort of a cool story. My dad played a bit of drums, and he and my mom split up when I was fairly young, but he did lead drums at the house, and that was sort of an early inspiration. It's funny, you know, I just sort of fell into it, and it just continued just over time, and it hasn't stopped since. It's funny.
And in particular, who were some of your earlier influences and what led you to pursue jazz as your primary form of musical expression?
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of people, I heard the music of the time and that was on the radio. I was, this is actually a bit before my time, but I was a big Ringo fan and still am. And a lot of the music that was around at the time, you know, I'm, you know, most Canadian drummers, you can't sort of get around Neil Peart or, yep, you know, people like that. And then what happened, once I got into high school, I think there was a pretty hot drummer at my high school whose younger brother was my best friend. And he was in grade 12 and I was in grade 9. And he was playing quite well. And then I don't have a lot of memories like this, but I do remember going over to his house one time, you know, these two brothers, and the younger brother playing me Seven Steps to Heaven with that great Tony drum solo. And I remember thinking, that's a really cool song, and that's an incredibly cool drum solo. And I think that's what really sparked it. And it was just a way of challenging myself. I don't know if I necessarily planned to play jazz in particular. For a long time, I sort of was weird about admitting that I was a jazz drummer just because I like everything. But I'm that's a mantle I'm willing to take on at this point in my life. So that's sort of how it developed.
When I was a student at post-secondary school as a jazz major, one of the things that I often find is that when students were having conversations about the musicians who inspired or influenced them, what I usually would find, what would happen is that the conversations that would come up or the names that would be dropped were all the names that you felt like you were supposed to say. And one of the things that I tended to go towards was the people that would say who their biggest inspirations were. And then we looked at the jazz musicians that we were being introduced to as the new inspirations. But a lot of times people would come in and say, oh, well, it's I'm inspired by Tony Williams. I'm inspired by Philly Joe Jones or Max Roach. But at that point, you could tell based on their experience that the first time they had heard of these musicians was actually in their first year class when they were exposed to these. And being a musician, you're kind of a melting pot of influences and inspirations. And those combinations is what leads you to help develop your own style. So you kind of have to learn and go through different styles of things, try different things to figure out kind of who you are. And that's really a big process. But I would gravitate towards the other musicians who had the same original influences that I did, and then enjoy the process of discovering all of the new influences together.
Yeah. And I think that you bring up a really good point, is that I think those early influences, because I think you'll go through a period, I think, as a young student studying, and go, well, it's not cool that I like Peter Criss, or it's not cool that I like Alex Van Halen. But I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're still in there for me, and they were very formative, and I still love the things they play, and I don't want to throw anything out. You know what I mean? Yes. I want it all in there. So I think there's room for everything that appeals to you. And I think you're right. That's what makes us all unique, is our particular combination of all these things.
You can't deny your influences.
And I would be a little mistrustful of somebody who said, oh yeah, I was, you know, when I was in grade school, I was listening to Philly Joe Jones. I mean, they may have been, maybe if their parents were a thing. And influences show up in odd places. My father, you know, as well as being a drummer, so he introduced me to some pretty hip things, some of which I appreciated at the time and some I didn't. But one I did appreciate at the time is, I think I was in grade 10 and he got me a Papa Joe Jones record, and nobody else I knew who he was. In fact, they got him confused with Philly Joe Jones. And when I was like, no, this guy plays brushes and he's from Kansas City. And he still is massive, massive, massive for me. I mean, I learned so much from him, and that was totally, my dad got me to that particular influence years before it would have happened otherwise.
I got an album from Dom Family Arrow that was actually a Papa Joe Jones album called The Drums. And it's basically an instructional record. Like, the whole record is basically him teaching you different approaches for the brushes and in terms of different styles. And so it's almost like going onto YouTube these days and watching an instructional video, but yeah, it was done as an audio recording. And it's quite fascinating. And I remember listening to this and thinking, I'm incredibly blown away and inspired by this, because even though he's in essence just teaching you stuff and you're just listening, there's just the sound and the touch and the feel that he's getting was just so incredibly magical that that's something that I found to be very inspirational.
Absolutely. And on that recording, which I just listened to again not that long ago, he even talks about, of course, a bunch of people that he'd heard that never made a record or that. So you get a real insight into very early on with the instrument. You know, he might have been one of the first players to really modernize the drum set, because he really dealt with a hi-hat. You know, people like Baby Dodds and stuff did incredible things, but even you hear recordings of Baby Dodds in the 40s and stuff like that, he's still not using a hi-hat. You know, that wasn't part of his thing. You know, and even the idea of playing with the ride rhythm, if you check out Papa Joe Jones, he was doing on the hi-hat, although he didn't do it on the ride. Like, he was way before, you know, that 60s thing of, now the ride rhythm is going to be sort of this line of notes and it's just, you know, sort of this dialogue. But he was already doing that. But for whatever reason, he would do it when he was playing his hi-hat, but not do it when he's playing the ride cymbal.
When you were starting out and you started to develop an interest in jazz, did you go through a lot of this discovery on your own, or were you starting formal education at that point?
No, I you know, I think there were some cool things about the era I grew up in, because it was sort of a bit of a, and where I grew up as well, the geographical location, because it was a bit of a dead zone. So I grew up in Regina, Saskatchewan, and so up until I would say the mid to late 80s, which by that time I'd already left town, is finding jazz records was really hard. There was a good selection at the local library that you would check out, and then there'd just be odd things that you would find at the record store. So you could find, for instance, you could find Electric Miles, which was cool, but you couldn't find any of the classic, you know, acoustic records. Or, you know, the only Sonny Rollins records you could find were ones from 1975 onwards, which, you know, that's okay, but it doesn't give you a really clear indication of what these people were doing. Then after that point, Blue Note did this huge reissue, and then all these records started coming out again. And I remember that too. It felt like a real bonanza at that point. I was just like, holy crap, you know, like there's all this music. But we really had to dig for it.
I remember one of my assignments in first year when I was at college was my instructor gave me a list of about a dozen jazz albums. And he said, your homework is to buy these and to listen to them. And I'm not sure most of the other students actually did that, but to me, that's part of the education. To me, having to track an album down that you can't just go to the little local store to find is part of the inspiration. And that means when you actually find it, you treasure it and you value it, and then you come back and you just want to just devour the information on it. Now, at the time, it was probably over my head, but it was my introduction to learning this style. Now I often say 30 years out of jazz college, I now probably am starting to be more comfortable in terms of applying a lot of the concepts, but you have to go through this process in the first place. And I think I bought them all on cassette at that point, and I've rebought every single one of them on CD. And I like having the album because it has the liner notes. And to me, reading the liner notes and reading the concepts behind the compositions and finding who the musicians are, that's part of the process for me that I particularly enjoy.
Yeah, and one thing, I've gotten into a situation recently where it's harder for me to physically practice the drums away from the gigs. So as a result, I've gone on to a really big listening thing again, which has been great. And one of the things that just came up recently, I think it was Branford Marsalis was talking about sound, and he talked about listening in terms of you developing sound, because you get the idea of sounds in your head. And often drummers don't talk about this much. And I found it's made a huge difference, like just listening to people with a really strong sound. Yeah, someone like Art Blakey or Tony Williams or lots of people, you know, Zigaboo Modeste. You know, there's a zillion people who have a really strong sound. But I think the more you get that into your head, the more it can help you develop what you want to do with your sound. And it's, you know, it's weird. It's a subtle thing, but I think it makes a huge difference. And listening's the key. I don't think there's any other way at it, really. You know, you're not going to get that from a book.
Yeah. Listening is the key, and application is the key, and not being afraid to not sound good as you go through and work through this process. And I know for myself, that's one of the things that I struggle with, is that when I'm in my practice room and I put on some music to play along with, I'm pretty comfortable and I'm trying to emulate certain things that I hear, and I'm trying to just respond musically to other things that I hear. Then when I take myself out of the comfort of my practice room and put myself on the bandstand, the anxiety of trying to fit into the role that I think I'm supposed to fit into starts to kick in. And then what happens is that I'm now playing all the things that I go back to, like my first year in college and in high school, and I start to play all the things that I think everyone's expecting me that I'm supposed to do. And it actually, you know, and I can do it, but I actually find it creatively frustrating, because I just want to be able to find that kind of, you know, flow zone and be able to just play and respond and not be afraid to give value to my own ideas and my concepts and embrace that, because I can do that in this context. But it's one of the things that I find about me, a musician, is trying to get over the challenges of your headspace.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that sometimes helps, or has for me, is just trying to get out of that space around the drum set and just trying to hear the whole thing. So you're trying, almost listening like a producer would, you know. And there was a in Peter Erskine's book, he talked about that because he was having a lot of trouble. He was at the ECM studios and he felt, you know, all that pressure of all the great music that had been played there. And, you know, Jan Christensen and Dejanet and people like that. And he said, you know, the first day he didn't feel like he sounded very good. And apparently Manfred Eicher took him aside and said, just play what you would like to hear. Mm-hmm. Do that. And I think that's a good way of viewing it. Not, you know, it's really easy for us to get psyched out by, you know, the image of whoever playing some sort of music, you know, because this music has been played so well by so many people. But, you know, I think that's an important point of you bringing up too, is even just trying to discover your own things at the kit too. That it doesn't have to be something you've heard before in a certain way to be valid. If it's something you hear or feels comfortable for you or makes sense to you or excites you, that's a good thing to have in there, you know. And I think the more concept you have and the more well you know tunes and forms and are able to do that, the more anything it will, the music will sustain almost anything you can want to play. I've been in situations where I've heard people play stuff that was almost audacious in terms of what it was, but it totally made sense because they believed it. The intent comes across, you know.
David Garibaldi once said to me that it is essential for musicians to value your own ideas because not everyone is going to value your ideas. If you have something that you want to express and that is who you are and that is your voice, that idea has value. It's not the determination of someone else to determine that if your idea has value, if it's a value to you, it has value. Now, it's all about putting things into the right context. You may be hired to be put into a context and play a certain role. And if your perception doesn't fit into the role of which you have accepted, then you have to start altering that situation. But sometimes we run into the challenge of wondering whether or not the things that we're creatively expressing actually have value because of our own insecurities.
Yeah. And context is a huge issue, right? Yeah. You know, because it's true. You can, you know, a capable drummer can ruin any gig quite well if he or she doesn't play with taste and discretion. I remember one time I filled in for somebody and I was just playing with a pub singer that was, you know, the other drummer had car trouble. I lived near the pub and he said, "You want to play this?" I said, "Sure." So it was actually this Irish guy. So the full deal, right? And yeah. he was hilarious. He let people come up on stage and sing. It was really the pub vibe. And the only thing he said to me is he said, "You know, I really don't like drum fills that much. Like, you don't have to play much." I said, "Okay, sure, fine." And I don't know if I think I took that as I'm going to try not to play any drum fills. Yes. I think I'm pretty close. And it was cool, right? Because it fit the vibe. It was this about this singer-songwriter getting these tunes across to a bunch of drunken students and them having a good time. And if I was doing that correctly, I'd fulfilled my function. And it was fun, actually. It was, you know, it wasn't going to get me, you know, an Instagram channel with millions of followers, but that's not what the gig was about anyway, you know?
I often find when I'm talking to students, one of the things I try and instill to them is the value of just exploring different types of music and being open to different types of music. And you don't have to like it, but you should just be aware of it. And why that makes you a better player is that it makes you understand other contexts better. Because drummers understand drummers. So we can say, "Hey, when you do this, you want to play a paradiddle beat here and you want to do this." And we can explain what we want and we understand that. But we've all been in situations where the artist that we're playing for will turn around and say, "I need this to be more like a flowing green grass with the water in the background." Yeah. And we don't necessarily know what that means because we're thinking, is it a 16th note funk groove in the style of Stevie Wonder? Or they might not know how to explain it, but they might say, "I want it to be in the style of Tower of Power," or maybe in the style of the Meters. And if you understand the feels for that, it's much easier for you to emulate things in the context that they are looking for. I remember I played in a band years ago, and one of the songs we did was Higher Ground by Stevie Wonder. And the conflict in the band was The bass player wanted to play the Red Hot Chili Peppers version of it, and the rest of the band wanted to play the Stevie Wonder version of it, and they do not blend together, even if it's the same song, because it all depends in terms of the context. And so it's really about kind of finding finding the right situation. Or I had a conversation once with Mark Kelso about James Brown. And we talked about how James Brown is not jam music. James Brown is puzzle music. Everyone needs to learn their piece. And all of those pieces are very simplistic. They're not easy to play. Sometimes simplistic can be the most challenging things to play correctly. But everyone has to play their part. And when those parts lock together, there is no greater feeling in terms of that sort of style of music and how to connect with that audience. But it's if you don't understand the context of that, then that's where sometimes you can be out of your comfort zone.
Sure. And that's very astute of Mark. Yeah, I've often thought of that music. It's like gears going together.
Yes.
And so it's all about the total whole effect. So if somebody isn't willing to hold up their end of that particular bargain, it's not going to work. That music is very hypnotic. So that's why you end up playing the same thing a lot of the time, because it's not because Clyde Stubblefield couldn't think of something else to play. He could think of a lot of things to play.
Yes.
What a creative, brilliant player. But he understood that to create this momentum and feeling in the music, it's not going to change. You know, that's another thing that jazz drummers get into sometimes, myself included, drives me a bit nuts, is that they will think that every measure has to be different. Now, that's cool, and that can be a great way to approach the music. But there's also the hypnotic thing. You know, even someone like Philly Joe Jones playing on Milestones, you know, he plays a rim click on 4 all the way through. Again, he's not doing that because he doesn't have something else to play. He has lots to play. In fact, it makes me think that was sort of when Miles was getting to this modal thing where there are less chords.
Yes.
And I wonder if almost that was Philly Joe's response to that, you know, because Philly Joe played piano and stuff like that. So I almost wonder if that was a harmonic thing that made him go, oh, maybe this needs to be more grounded in some sort of way. So I'll just play this pattern all the way through. You know, it's fascinating, this stuff, you know. And that's the other thing. This stuff doesn't exist in isolation. The harmony and the melody and the rhythm, they all go together and they all influence each other. You know, I run into a lot of players that they can only see the whole thing from the drums point of view. And you miss out on a lot of stuff and a lot of context if you do that, you know.
When I was at college, the person I studied with for all 3 years, because I went to Mohawk College, was Kevin Dempsey. And I remember one of the things that Kevin would assign you is he'd say, okay, next week you're coming in and this is the jazz standard you need to learn. But he would make you sit down and play the song on a piano first. So you had to sit down and you had to play the chords and you had to play the melody of the piece. You didn't have to play it well, but you had to have at least taken the time to sit down to be able to play one time through the form, playing the melody and playing the chords. And he said, because if you don't know how the song goes, as soon as you sit behind the drums, you're not playing that song. You're just playing a beat. And so it's always about in terms of the context. And I always find if you take the time to have to really get into the music and really learn the parts, even if it's outside of your comfort zone, you do the best that you can. It's going to make you a much more sympathetic and musical player.
Totally. And, you know, suddenly there's a whole context for something you would play on a tune that won't be the same on another tune because it has a different melody. It has a different set of changes, has a different form. I often say to people, you know, can you self-generate this? So say we want to play Stella by Starlight. Can you play it on the drum set and let me know I'm hearing that song? Mm-hmm. And often that's not even sort of a super technical thing. That's a thing about hearing it in your head and making everybody else hear it. You know, it's sort of a sleight of hand that we do on this instrument, is that because we're playing stuff that generally it doesn't have determinate pitches. But if we convince people, you know, with enough concept of the tune we're playing, if they're aware and sensitive too, they will hear that tune, you know, which is crazy. It's like abstract art, right? We're making them hear something that actually isn't there. You know, I can sing while I'm practicing some exercise paradiddles or something and sing it to Stella by Starlight. And it suddenly gives it a whole different context. It's, you know, if you just listen to it in the abstract and you don't know that tune, you just go, okay, it's just this, I'm just playing a bunch of stuff on the drums. But if you get somebody who's aware of all these things, I can, you know, I can make them hear it. You know, it's very cool.
an exercise I've often given to younger students, and I don't necessarily mean age-wise, I just mean earlier in their development journey as a student, is that, you know, I'm teaching them how to read rhythms, I'm teaching them to understand rhythms, and then I'll get them to pick 2 to 4 words and put them together, and I'll say, play them on the drum set. Mm-hmm. Because now you're not thinking, okay, I have this 8th note followed by these 2 6, and they're not stressing about the rhythms. I just tell them, pick words, and then I will change the order of the words, and then I don't care what they do. I just want them to play words. And then my homework assignment will be go home and, you know, write, take a sentence from a book and spend 30 minutes playing that sentence. And then usually what happens is that they come back and they've learned the rhythms that I wanted them to learn. They just haven't thought of them in terms of that specific context. So if they're struggling with a certain rhythm, there's almost a word that will fit the phrasing of that rhythm for almost every rhythm context at that level. And I find for them, it's easier because now they can come up with their own phrases, and particularly for younger kids, they like that better, and it turns into a kind of a fun exercise. And I find it allows them to be more musically creative. And then I find myself as an advanced student, I will often come home and assign myself the same exercise because I tend to fall into the habit of trying to incorporate the things in the books that I have on my music stand. And then I say, wait a second here, I'm losing the phrasing aspect of things. So it's a never ending journey.
Yeah, that's a cool exercise. I'll try that one too. That's an interesting approach, you know. And I think text is an interesting thing too, because of course with text, you can change around orders of things and stuff like that. And that's sort of what we're doing too, right? Yep. There's no such thing as one rhythm. One rhythm is an infinite number of rhythms, just depending on where you put it in the bar, or if you accent it, or if you articulate it differently. There's, you know, the really great improvisers realize that. It's not necessarily that you have an infinite amount of stuff, but you have an almost infinite amount of ways of playing the stuff you know. Mm-hmm. You know, moving things around in the bar, playing it backwards, playing it, squishing it together, expanding it, you know, all that stuff, how you voice it on the instrument, you know, it just goes on and on and on, you know.
Now, as a student yourself, looking back, you actually studied at McGill University in Montreal, and you also studied jazz at St. Francis Xavier in Nova Scotia. So looking back to those times, what were some of the most profound lessons that you learned, and maybe what were some of the biggest challenges you had to overcome at that stage of your development?
Dave Liebman was there. And what was interesting was, you know, and he's generally known as a saxophone player, but he played some drums and he talked to the drummers. And it was interesting because, you know, and even it was interesting because you could tell he had played with Elvin Jones because his body language was very similar. But it was sort of like Elvin if Elvin had never actually practiced or anything. Like, it was this really crude version of Elvin's thing. But within it, I heard so much music, and that got me on the whole thing where I thought, okay, and it took a long time for this lesson to really sink in, but that maybe it was on the wrong track in a way. That I thought if I learned enough fancy, complicated things and played fast enough, I was going to play the music. And it made me realize that I need to maybe refocus in some ways around learning the music. Let's see, what were some of the other lessons? I mean, when I was at McGill, there was a lot of great music in town and a lot of great drummers there. The older drummers that were still playing, Gina Dawn, who was Force of Nature, Andre White, who's still around, and then a lot of my peers too, and we learned a lot together. And also at McGill, I got to play a lot. I didn't make any money, but I certainly got a lot of experience. I played with people and sort of, you know, made all my mistakes, you know, playing the music, which was terrific, you know.
Well, and it's that feedback and those experiences, if you embrace the feedback, that can just make you stronger. And I remember when I was at Mohawk College, one of the ensembles that I was in was led by Mark Eisenman, who, as you know, is one of Canada's premier, you know, jazz pianists, and I learned a ton from Mark. And what he would always say to me is, I don't know anything about the drums, but here, I want you to try this. And so it'd just be a matter of, you know, take this rhythm that you're playing, which is cool, but shift it over by a note and let's just see what that sounds like. And then suddenly made it sound awkward,
but suddenly brought everything to life. And it was really just about, you know, not being afraid to experiment and to try things and kind of get outside of your comfort zones, because we all tend to go back into our comfort zones in a lot of these situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mark's a great teacher. I actually took some piano lessons with him too, and that was fantastic. He really is something else.
He thinks very compositionally as opposed to very technically. And I think sometimes we can, you know, as students, whether we're learning an instrument or whether we're learning melody or harmony skills, we tend to kind of get very much and caught up in terms of the rules that we're supposed to follow. But you kind of have to learn the rules to learn that you don't have to follow the rules, and that you just can, you know, be creative and explore. By learning the rules, it expands the things that you didn't take into consideration. And that's one of the things that I like about learning, is that I may not always want to have to follow the rule, but learning a new thing inspires you to go in a different direction you may not have considered.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, too, even, you know, those things that end up becoming rules or seem like rules just come from general principles of things that work. And I think, you know, there sometimes can be more malleable than one thinks, you know? And I think Mark's a great example of that. I think he's somebody who, a lot of what he's gotten together is by playing, you know, it's really always relates back to playing. I don't think he's somebody who spent a lot of time playing etudes and things like that. I don't think he did. I think he learned by doing it and doing it with people and hearing people he liked and trying to emulate what he heard. So there's not a lot of, I think, superfluous stuff in it, both in when he performs and when he teaches. He really gets to the heart of the matter. And I think he's a great example of that. You know, all his students sound great, and none of them sound like him, but they all sound great, and they all deal with the time, you know?
And another thing I've often said to students is that when they're listening to certain recordings, depending on the context of the music that they're listening to, but they often get caught out about trying to emulate everything perfectly. And so what I remind them is that the recordings that we're listening to were snapshots of a moment at that particular time. And if you saw that collection of artists, again, playing the same music, it's going to be completely different. Because it's a different moment, it's a different experience. The moods that people are going through are very different from the moods that they were on on that particular day. There's always the story about, I think it's Miles Davis's, I think it's his Four More album, where the tempos were ridiculously fast. And the story that I had heard was the band was told they were being paid as they're actually walking onto the stage to perform this. And so that was one of the reasons why everything kind of had this completely different energy. It's important to get into the context of the music and to kind of embrace things, but not always worry about perfection. But part of the learning process is to analyze the things that came before you to figure out why that worked, and then hopefully spark some other
Absolutely,
ideas.
For sure. And I think, unfortunately, we're in a world, makes it sound like I want everybody to play jazz, but I don't necessarily. But where it's all about this product, and this thing is perfect, and it's perfect if it sounds exactly like the recording you heard, you know. Whereas it used to be. I was just again reading about Van Halen's early days and talked about how when they played cover tunes, they played them the way they played them. They still sound like Van Halen played. Yep. Which I think is cool. It can be this expressive thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be this, you know, and there's nothing wrong with those classic albums, live things, and people enjoy them. I get it. But I think we've gotten to a point where it almost gets to a point where people don't know what a really good live band might sound like. Or if it's different, it doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It just means it's different, you know?
As an educator yourself who has taught at a number of post-secondary environments, what are some of the things that you have seen in your students when they're first coming in to study jazz that are maybe not coming from that background? What are some of the challenges that you see that they are encountering, and how do you help overcome that?
I think dynamic range is huge, and it's funny because it's just something one has to practice. You know, it is challenging. I get it. I deal with it as much as anybody, but grading intensity without necessarily creating volume There are lots of ways to create intensity, and volume is a great one, but it's not the only one. What else? I mean, I think a certain amount of, maybe they might be intimidated to play brushes so that they don't play brushes very often. Mm-hmm. And then they don't feel good when they play brushes. So they don't play brushes very often. You know, there's things like that. Or even just thinking about the instrument in sort of a more melodic sense. Not necessarily just as, you know, you can think of the snare drum isn't necessarily something that you play 2 and 4 on, although it can be, and it is a great thing and great sound when we do that. But these things can also be tonal generators, you know, so you can think about them as different parts of the melody. And, you know, you can just use the actual tones of the drums to create pictures or ideas, or, you know, that we don't have to always, and even the way we practice things like coordination, I find that everybody or a lot of people tend to practice it all the same way. It's always, we're coordinating things in one direction, but maybe not in another one, or we're not, it's hard to describe, but I would find just a lot of it's, they just don't have a lot of perspective, I guess. You know, and that again comes to listening. Some, I can still remember certain things I heard for the first time. I heard Now He Sings, Now He Sobs when I first went out to Santa Fex. I was 18 years old. And right from the second steps, what it was, I was like, what is that? Oh my God. You know, I'd never heard a sound like that. I'd never heard a tempo like that. I'd never heard a trio play that way. You know, you know, a lot of it's in input. You know, if you get enough input, it'll show you what's possible, I would say, you know. And then you can start experimenting based on that, you know, and finding your own ways to do that. I'm amazed at how much I get from just listening to somebody. I just before I copped on this call, I listened to a little bit of Mingus, and just this little thing that Danny Richman did and how he used it, and there was sort of a metric modulation between a ballad and a fast three, and the way Danny Richman plays fast three, it was really cool. And I just thought, oh yeah, I really need to check that more out and just incorporate some of that, because there's this great feeling he gets in this certain way. You know, a great underrated player, because he was just mainly associated with Charles Mingus, but a great player nonetheless. And actually, I got to see him late in his career on the first time I went to New York, and it was awesome. You know, he was wearing a big floppy white hat. He was about this thin. And he was awesome. He sounded great. He sounded fantastic.
I was fortunate enough to see Wayne Shorter at least a couple of times. And I had saw him at Massey Hall with Brian Blade on drums and Danilo Perez and John Patitucci. And I was blown away by the intensity, but I didn't quite understand what it was that I was seeing, because I was so used to listening to Wayne Shorter records. Mm-hmm. And then later on, I started to realize that that's not what Wayne Shorter is going to do. He's very much about mm-hmm. capturing a moment and not repeating the previous moment. And then I saw them again a few years later at Kerner Hall in Toronto. And I always tend to sit in the cheap seats, because then I'm behind the stage, raised above, and I get the bird's eye perspective. And I remember thinking, this is cool, because I can see they have sheet music. They know what it is they're going to play, but yet there's these really long moments in between the pieces where the band's just looking at each other and they're waiting for inspiration. And then the piano player might play something, which then would spark the bass player to play something. And then the drummer would kick it. And then they're just playing. They're not playing the piece. There's the pieces on the music stand. They're just playing. They're creating. And then at some point, once the moment is ready, the song starts. And I thought, this is fascinating, because these people have been playing together for, at that time, I think it was 17 years as a quartet, but yet they're still feeling out the situations. And it's really just about sort of capturing that moment. And I found that to be incredibly eye-opening and incredibly inspirational, because it wasn't about the moment is trying to capture everything exactly the way it was rehearsed. The moment is about, yes, being prepared. I'm not one to ever say that you should never be prepared. You should always be prepared for the jobs that you take on. But there's always that little element of exploration and just kind of allowing what's supposed to happen to happen.
For sure. For sure. I've seen it play a fair amount of times too. And it was always fun. And they're always moments where I, and this was very refreshing, where I had no clue what was going on. I was like, I don't know. And then all of a sudden, yes, they'd start playing a tune. And I was like, oh, that sounds a bit like Penelope or something. You know what I mean? Like, okay. But, and that was really a great part of it. You know, you can get used to a very, you know, even playing jazz, you know, head, solo, head, you know, thing. That's one way of approaching it. It's not the only one. Or, you know, that elements of it can be structured, but then elements within that can be very free, or the opposite. You can have a structured thing in the middle of a very free piece. You know, I think those things are very, you know, I think they really ran with that. And that was a great part of that band, for sure.
Now, throughout your career, you have had the opportunity to play with a lot of the who's who of the Canadian jazz scene, and your resume is extremely impressive in terms of the things that you've accomplished. But you're also a composer, you're a writer, and you have released a number of albums under your own project, the Ted's Warren Commission Project. What's your approach for composition?
It changes. I'm not great at writing as often as I would like to. I just sort of do it as it strikes. So sometimes it might be a contrafact. It might be a chord progression that I'm interested in and might want to explore. Sometimes it's a melodic fragment. Sometimes it's a bass line. Sometimes you can come from, you know, extra musical sources, meaning a quote or a picture of somebody. There's a great piano player on the who's in Portland, George Colgan, and he had a blog post. It was just like 50 ways to write tunes. And so a lot of them were really interesting. It was like, write a theme song for yourself that would play as soon as you came in the room if it was a sitcom, or write something about, you know, like, and then very much more concrete things like write a blues with a bridge, or write a blues with an odd form, or write a blues in an odd time structure, or write a blues with odd chords, you know. So I think sometimes I would just try things and see what came out. I haven't been composing much lately. My newest project actually is next week, and I'm finally going to do my first solo drum recording. I've done a lot of solo drum gigs, but we're recording it next Wednesday. It's all going to be improvised pieces, and I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be a little bit of a different thing for me, so it'll be fun. And that's just composing in the moment, you know, just whatever comes up.
Throughout the pandemic, one of the things that I had noticed too, because I'm following a lot of your posts, is that you found a lot of great inspiration in terms of taking the downtime from playing with other musicians and really just expanding your practice time and just developing your skills as a player and just exploration. And you found it to be a very sort of creative time, whereas many people found it to be a time of which everything kind of took a big step back. But because you posted things so frequently, I would be constantly inspired by a lot of the things that you had done. And looking at that time, was there any little things that you kind of discovered that maybe inspired you to kind of go in some different directions, or would inspire you to you know, maybe a following a certain composition or just pursuing something else?
I mean, I think there was a lot of forward movement for me in terms of sort of independent coordination. I worked on a lot of things, a lot of foot ostinatos and things like that. Also some technical things. I mean, even something as simple as, you know, getting my singles more together, which I've never liked ever. You know, that's the first agreement and the hardest one. It's the one we all live and die by.
It's probably my least favorite one, and I'm still working on it after 40 years.
It's the hardest one. It easily is. It's the simplest one, the hardest one. And then just applying it in certain ways. I mean, this can be a double-edged sword. I mean, during the lockdown and up leading up to about the last 6 months or so, I was practicing every single day, and there'd been years since that had happened. And so I did feel like I made some advancements, but the funny part about it, I will tell you this, is the first gig I did outside of the pandemic, it was like a thing in Hamilton. We were playing in a club, and it was actually like an online thing. But I remember as soon as we started playing, I thought, okay, I've been working on this, all this fancy stuff, and it has very little to do with what's going on right now. You know, are you playing time for the band, or are you helping them tell their story? It doesn't matter, you know, these swanky things you learn to do, especially if you're, you know, I mean, I think that's the fascinating thing about the drum set too, is that I'm a very ambitious player for sure. I like, you know, I'm going to do a solo record next week. I like expanding the role of it. I like taking on other musical roles other than a purely timekeeping one. But at the same time, like, I'm very aware that, you know, there are plenty of people that would be quite happy if you never played a solo as a drummer ever. And I get that too. You know, that it's a big part of what we do is creating grooves and moves, you know, movement and moods in the music. And it's easy to get away from that too much. You know, I think that's something I'm always balancing. You know, I saw somebody online doing something and they were explaining it lick, this guy, George Flutus, who's a great drummer. And I said to him, I actually couldn't concentrate on the lick he was trying to show me, because whenever he went to play time, I was just like, oh my God, that sounds so good. That's amazing. Like, I couldn't concentrate on the actual lick. It was just like, oh my God, doesn't that feel? Oh my God, that sounds so good. You know? And that's what it's about. I mean, really, I mean, if that's not there, it's okay, but it takes it out of a certain area that I want in the music, you know? You know, all these people, all the great drum solos were great time players, you know, the classic ones. So I'm sure there are ones on probably, you know, that online now that probably play interesting solos that maybe don't play time as well. But, you know, most of the great drummers, you know, that were great solos, they were great time players too, for sure.
Well, and I had said this in a recent episode, that one of the things that I find interesting about the different changes in terms of generations is that I fell in love with music and wanted to learn how to play the drums. And now a lot of the generations, because of social media and other things, people fall in love with the drums, but have to be introduced to music. So it's almost kind of shifted back. And that's not to say everything's like that. I find it interesting that I often have students come in and I need to teach them how to listen to a song and actually apply the skills that they have to song, but they're caught up in watching drum solos on YouTube. And there's definitely some value to that. It's just a matter of just really finding your inspiration from different places and finding what is the right thing for you. But I find it an interesting perspective.
Yeah, in certain worlds, there isn't a lot of emphasis on function. You know, I mean, I do see some people doing some incredible things. But I suspect some of them, not all of them, but I suspect some of them, even doing a wedding gig, wouldn't know what to do half the time. And, you know, that's sort of what we do. You know, oh, they're cutting the cake and they're playing a bell. Okay, you play Brushes Quietly. You know, sort of blend. Oh, okay, now they're going to play a disco song, you know, or, oh, you know, somebody wants to hear a waltz or whatever it is. You know, it's that stuff, I think, to certain crowd isn't that sexy, but it's huge in what we do. And that's what you want to do with the drums in those situations. You want to make people feel good and have a good time. That might be not necessarily the time you're going to do the most complicated thing you know how to do. Maybe it may work in there, but probably not.
And then sometimes I find the irony is that the most complicated thing to do is actually the simplest thing to play, because you are taught to do so many complex things and develop your coordination and develop your skills and your technique. And then so you learn, you want to use all the things that you developed. And then sometimes now you're given something that's just really simple and it's hard to do because you've gotten so far away from the fundamentals. But that's something that as you generally mature as a player or as a student, you tend to find your way back.
Yeah, I think that's what happens for most people. I think most people end up streamlining their playing over their career. I think I think that's just a matter of you know, you just get better at getting to the point. You know, so much of this is a storytelling process. And the clearer you can tell the story, and there are many different ways of doing that, probably the more effective it's going to be. That's another thing about a lot of these phenoms that I see online is they're doing these incredible things, but there isn't even a process of doling it out. Because it could be this thing where if you wait and then hit everybody with that incredible thing at that perfect moment, you're going to be, oh my God, you know, but it's usually not. They start with that. Yeah. And the only reason they're playing it is because they can do it. And I've always said to people, the worst reason to play something is because you can, you know, there's got to be something more than that, you know?
Now, this is probably going to be a very difficult question, but with the amount of recordings and performances and things that you've done, are there any particular recordings that you're particularly proud of that you would maybe recommend to someone if there was, if they were interested in checking out some things that you've done in your
career?
Sure.
I mean, I think because it's such a snapshot of the Toronto music scene at a certain time, I think all the Boss Brass records I did were that way. Especially one I'm particularly fond of is the one with Mel Torme, just because he, you know, I really went into that going, oh, okay, you know, Mel Torme, he's that old guy who was on Night Court. But I mean, he's playing so well and sounds so fantastic. And playing and singing these very difficult arrangements, you know, and parts that were very hard to sing. And he was all over, and he's well into his 70s at that point. And he sounded fantastic. I couldn't believe it. So those are good. That the one with Mel is called Velvet and Brass. I don't know if it's in print. You can probably find it online, you know, on YouTube or something. Most of the records with Mike Morley's quartet I like quite a bit. I think that was a good developing time of a bunch of young, hungry musicians. Sometimes I listen to it now and go, okay, you know, it's funny. You know, you go, wow, he had a lot of energy and he had a lot of ideas, you know. I wouldn't play like that now, but I mean, that's part of it too. You know, you get older. You know, and all my recordings I like that way, just because, you know, I was developing as a writer and band leader and, you know, as well as a drummer. I think those are a lot of them. It's funny. I don't keep track of them as well as I used to. I used to have copies of everything. I had them all in one place and stuff. And now I don't. You know, and if I need to find something, I'll often just go online and look for it because it's in this place somewhere, but I don't know where they are. You know, so I think anything where I was doing something different, there's a guy named Abby Granite, and he has a sextet, and that's definitely more outside music, and I like that. Or there's also a band in Guelph called the Vertical Squirrels, and that's really outside music, and that's fun too because it's different for me. It's very like the Squirrels; they're not tuned. We just start playing. That's all there is. We just play. In fact, we've never talked about the music in particular. And I think that's the reason it works. We just start playing, and so you're trying to develop a composition in the moment, and it's fun to do that. And I think there are a lot of people who are dedicated to doing just that, and that's very interesting to me. I don't think I'd always want to do that. I think I like doing a variety of things, but playing completely open music is a really fun challenge. And I think whatever work one's done on playing forms and more structured music helps in that environment because you are developing a structure with other people in the moment. You know, a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of listening involved. Sometimes you don't play much. Or you have to pick your times because you're trying to create these scenarios where it feels like, oh, this was a composed thing, and oh, here's a bass solo now. Well, if you keep playing at the same volume and the same density all the time, nobody's going to know it's a bass solo, so you got to back off or whatever it is. You know, I think those are good challenges. But anyway, Vertical Squirrels, Abbey Granite 6, those are some good ones too.
I find for me one of the most satisfying creative environments is similar to that, where you just there is no rules, there is no composite, you're just playing and you're feeding off the other musicians, and it can be very inspirational. And one of the least inspiring creative situations is having to recreate those moments, because sometimes what will happen is that you have those moments and then you decide, hey, this was good, we're gonna turn it into a piece and we're gonna play it again at the next one, and now you're trying to recreate those things that were really cool and they're never the same. So you have to kind of look at it as maybe we'll take the structure of what we're doing and go back in that one, but we're gonna have to take the moments that we experienced previously and just let those go and try and just experience new moments and turn it into something else, but with a starting
point. Yeah, and that's often the problem. Sometimes where a good gig or a good recording can be a problem because you love it so much, and then you realize, oh, I can't. It's going to be different the next time. You know, there's so many factors every time you play. You know, the sound of the room you're in, sound of your instrument, the people you're playing with. Are you tired? Are you hyper? You know, what's going on in your life? There's so many factors. And so I think one of the really important things as an improviser is to try and just go into it open-ended and without an agenda, which is sometimes challenging.
We've talked a lot about the technical aspects of things that you have learned and done over the years. Was there any kind of headspace or anxiety situations that you had to work through to overcome in order to kind of get you to the next level? Because one of the things we all are challenged with is mindset issues. And I'm always very interested in terms of, you know, some of the things that you kind of had to find outside outlets in order to help you get through that to really achieve the things that you really were striving to get.
I'm a big fan of mindfulness and meditation, which I try to do every day. And this was a long process, and it was also a process of, I used to be incredibly self-critical, and to the point where really it caused mental issues, it caused physical issues, and I think it never helped anything. That's the thing to keep in mind too.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happened for me, and I think this is another way that when we get a little less focused, especially in the moment on what we're doing, but rather than the whole thing that's going on, is I can remember when I was a young player, I'd be playing away and part of my mind is going, well, you suck, you suck, you suck. You know, being the worst person I could be to anybody. I would never do that to anybody else. So, but then often what would happen is somebody else that I was playing with would play something that was so compelling that I would forget to keep beating myself up. And I'd be still playing, and I'd be like sort of playing like an active listener who had sticks in their hand or something. And then all of a sudden I'd be, you know, so I'd just be sort of taken out of this misery by somebody playing something cool. And then all of a sudden I would come in that sort of split second of coming back to myself and go, wait a minute, this sounds pretty good. And I used to call it, you know, that I forgot that I sucked. You know, I forgot to suck, because that's the thing. As soon as I had a little distance from it, I was like, oh, this guy plays okay. You know, and I think especially when you're performing and playing with people, that's the mindset you want to be in. You want to be sort of aware of yourself and listening to yourself and listening to everything else and listening to it in context. And I think that can take away a lot of that pressure on oneself. You know, it's perfection is I think is overrated. And I think, and even what perfection is that there's a lot of debates about what that could be. So I found the more I was just sort of accepting of myself, especially when I was playing or performing, or recording, you know, any situation where this is just it, it's going to go. It's a little different when you're in a practice room. You can be constructively and lovingly critical. I use that in the best sense of that, just saying it's almost like it's another person. Oh, that Ted guy, you know, he sure rushes when he does this. And it's okay. Well, yeah, maybe I should check that out. But, you know, I think when you're performing, and I would include recording in this element, is this is your time to go, man, I get to do this cool thing and I'm just going to present it to people and I love doing it. I hope you love it too. And that's sort of all you can do. You know, as soon as I would be obsessing about the stupidest thing and be like, oh man, my foot chops are terrible. Well, if you're telling that, but you know, as somebody's counting off the take, how's that going to help you? It's not going to help you. It will definitely not help you. It'll probably hinder you. So and the funny part is I have a way better time now too. I have a good time. Now at the same time, I find when things are going well, I don't deify them as much as I used to either. You know, I think when you're young and you're playing, it's almost like you're when you're in love, you start losing your mind and you can't really function. And if you stay that way, it would eventually kill you. But what happens when you're older is it's more like you're in a mature relationship and you're going with the ups and downs and you don't get too excited and you take it all in. And even if you have a bad night, so, well, you know, I'll do it again tomorrow. It'll probably be different, you know, or if you're playing in a situation where it isn't working that well, to realize that you were just one member of this whole thing and you can only do so much. You know, you can't, if you're playing with somebody else in the band who really hasn't done their homework on their instrument or the music, you can't make up for it eventually. I can't correct somebody's wrong changes, you know, on guitar. That's I don't have that magical ability from the drums, you know.
Yeah.
So I think in accepting that and just going, well, I'll just do what I do, you know. I remember seeing Elvin Jones one time And I saw him a couple sets in a row. And the funny thing is, the last side I saw was a different night. It wasn't as good as the other ones. It was still great. I mean, he's held it. But the heaviest thing was at the end of the set, he goes, "Well, thanks so much. We've been just trying to play our best for you people and just having a good time playing music. That's really all it is." And then remember that, that's actually a great lesson for me, because it was a point, because I thought, here's this guy who's played on some of the heaviest music I've ever imagined, and he's saying, "We're just playing and trying to have a good time." You know, like I think that's how you can play on Love Supreme. Because I think if he had been too inside his head, he wouldn't have been able to play that way. He was just letting it go and just, you know, being in the moment and going with what was inspiring him. And that's why you end up with that. I think if you constrict it, it's can be a real problem. You know, you're going to get to, you know, just your best stuff, your best approach to the music.
Well, and sometimes we become so critical about trying to make sure we get everything correct that we forget about why we're doing this in the first place.
Yeah.
And we need to be reminded of that. This is actually fun. This is something that we're doing because it's actually joyful. Yeah, and there's definitely a process, but I think when you get off track, you need to go back to why you wanted to do this in the first
place. Yeah, I think so. And the funny part is, I mean, it's more fun for me than it's ever been. I think as you develop, then there are more things, it's just more open. You know, you're not worried about this stuff, so you're just having a good time. I have so much fun when I play, both when I perform, when I practice too. And that's another thing that was great about the lockdown for me, is I still enjoy practicing. Some people don't, and I get that. Some people just like to play gigs, and after a certain point, they stop practicing. And I get that, but there's a research and development part of it that I really find fascinating. I still do. I like finding these threads of things, either from other players or from a book. I've been going through the Gad book. I love that. Or things I've heard and are imitating, or even just things I cooked up in my head. You know, what would happen if I did this? I still really enjoy that process. You know, I just read about Sonny Rollins and his biography, and I would not compare myself to any way to him, but the fascination with the instrument and trying to play it the best you can and playing music the best you can, I identify with that. I do. I think there's a certain amount of me that's ambitious and wants to do it better than I used to. You know, some people don't, and that's fine. I'm not denigrating what they want to do, but I'm always trying to find new things and new horizons, you know, in what I'm doing.
For me, a joyful practice session inspires me to want to run back down again the next day and pick up from where I left off. And I usually try and tell my students, you should never walk out of a practice session not wanting to go back. You should always end a practice session with something that really makes you can't wait to run back and sit behind.
And I think if you, even if you're not, it's not starting that way. I think if you hang in there, it usually gets to that point. It does for me, for sure. I had a great teacher who used to come out to a camp that I used to go to when I was a kid, named Jack Mouse, a great drummer from Chicago. And he said, the thing about drum practicing is this really hard move you have to do. It's where you take your butt and you take it out wherever it's been and you put it on the drum stool and then you put the sticks in your hand. And usually after that, it goes okay. And he's another guy. I mean, he's probably in his 70s. He still practices every day, I think, you know, and he's still performing. So, you know, that's that attitude that you can probably find something new every time you come to the instrument, you know.
Yeah, it's a process that I love. I had to learn how to find joy in my practicing, but once I learned how to find focus and joy in my practicing, I find it changes my mindset. It gives me energy. It inspires me to achieve success in every other aspect of my life. It's a great way to develop better bonds in your relationships. If I'm having a bad day, the first thing my wife does is go downstairs for 10 minutes and just play the drums and then come back up in 10 minutes, and it energizes you. And it's just, it's amazing how powerful music with focus.
Yeah. And I was supposed to say, my wife says the exact same thing. And like I said, it's a little trickier now. I can rig up something where I can play, you know, a snare drum with some pillows on it or something. So it's not quite as inspiring, but you know, there's always something you can do, you know, or I can play piano, or I can do some listening, or, you know, I can mentally practice. There's always a way at it. So even if you're in a situation like I am, where you really can't play where you are, there's always something you can do. You know, there's no way, there's no excuses really.
So as we start to wind up here, I'm always curious about advice that you would give to kind of like the next generation? So if you have some younger students coming in, or just whether it be drum students or other musicians, and they're just looking for some advice from someone that's been doing this a really long time, what advice can you offer?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly in the realm of music I'm involved in, it's never been a very easy way to make money. So, and I don't see this as a negative thing, but I would say to most of them, if you want to play music, do it because you want to play music and that it fulfills something in you that you need to express. It may not be the way you make money, and I don't think that's a problem. I think some people, and myself included, used to get really weird about, oh, being a professional musician was my identity, and that's this badge of honor I wore. But yeah, I make money from many sources now, some involving playing, some don't. And what it does mean is whenever I play, I get to have a great time. I enjoy myself. I give it my all. And so I think that's as being as professional as anything is, you know. So I would say to a lot of them, find something else you'd like to do that might help you monetarily so that you can enjoy the music and not create pressure on yourself.
And I think it's probably going to tie into this, but what would you define as success?
Ooh, yeah, I guess, finding, again, it would be around those things, finding a way to express yourself that's unique to you and creating a good feeling in the music whenever I'm involved, both maybe even just spiritually as a human being, that I think most people like playing with me because I'm not a drag. this is very much based on the sort of thing I do. You know, I know a lot of people, you know, it's important to them to, you know, make money only from playing, and that's fine. I applaud them for that. It's a very tricky thing to do. But for me, yeah, it's just about expressing something. And I think just trying to learn new things all the time. You know, one of my old, I had a Louis Belson book, one of the many he wrote. And one it says in the first page, I think it says, a good musician learns something new every day. And I thought, that stuck with me. I thought, yeah, right, Louis, you're correct. And he was a great example. I mean, even near the end of his life, he was working on composition and larger pieces and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's what he was doing, you know. So I think, for me, just continuing to learn and grow.
And for people that want to learn more about you or reach out to connect, I know you do have a blog, you do have a YouTube channel, and you've also started mm-hmm. a Patreon page that really helps to kind of introduce people to your teaching concepts. So in addition to that, or along that lines, what's the best way to connect?
Think, yeah, any of those. I'm on social media. All are under my own name. Facebook, Twitter, I refuse to call it X, Instagram. Yeah, you said you can find the blog, you can find me on YouTube. Any of those are fine. You know? Yeah, I try to be just, you know, available in a number of ways. And yeah, I love chatting with people about music, you know, or teaching, you know.
Well, it's through social media that I reached out to you and we were able to sort of establish this, but I've been following you for a long time. I'm incredibly inspired by your forthcoming solo jazz recording. It's something I will definitely be checking out, but it has been an absolute pleasure to connect with you. And I can't wait to the opportunity to come to one of your shows and actually be able to carry on this conversation.
Me too. Yes, thank you so much. This has been delightful.
Listening to the Drummer's Pathway podcast. Please share and subscribe, get the word out, and let's keep the discussion going. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.